This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are in San Francisco with Dr. Richard Lannan. I told you when we began, this is not a book show. We don't push books. But the fact is that this book may be one of that dozen books in the course of a lifetime that really can change how people see things, as to be distinguished from bookstores full of self-help books. What's the difference? Why does a self-help book maybe not work? And you're saying, and we can do something if we're in pain.
A lot of self-help books actually teach or try to teach people to do something alone. You know, it's funny. It's a curious thing, but it's
I just fix myself and all by myself.
And then I'll fix myself all by myself.
I can fix it.
And this will work. And that's just doesn't work. And so we don't look at this as a self-help book, because what we're basically hoping is that people will read it and then be connected with other people. And that's really what helps and heals. So the other thing is, a lot of self-help books are very cognitive. You know, you try to think.
Seven steps to.
Yeah, and you try to think your way. Now, you can get some place with that, and we're not saying, you know, there's nothing there. You can get some place with that, but it doesn't go all the way down to your emotional core.
This is counter-Western. We are supposed to be able to control our emotions. You know, it is just right at the heart of I think how we, certainly our generation was raised, and I think it's, you know, it's an American and Western, and arguably, you know, and more broadly human, that it is incumbent on us to control our emotions, and that control can be exercised rationally. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm hearing you say is, it's an illusion. Both of those are illusions. You cannot, in fact, control your emotions in the sense that we typically think of.
What we think of as control, which is very cognitively.
Well, it is cognitive manipulation.
Yes, that we can control our emotional state, how we feel.
We can repress them.
Well, and they're probably bad anyway.
Oh, by the way, yes, they are. They are bad.
Yeah,
I forgot that part.
But you know, more the. I think the metaphor would be like a horse with a rider. I mean, our mind can help us ride the horse, but the horse is there, and the rider is not going to talk the horse out of being a horse. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Try as the rider might.
Right. There's. In some ways, this is, as you say, this is, you know, when you see it, it's trivially obvious, but it's also extraordinarily difficult. This notion of implicit memory and its importance is again, it's intuitively obvious once you can accept it, but it goes against all of our expectations.
Well, and that there are two completely different kinds of memory.
Right.
And it's not, as you say, so eloquent. Dr. Lewis says so eloquently in the book, the way he articulates it for all three of you.
Yeah.
How'd I do? That it's not a rock. Memory is not this stone monolith.
Right.
Tell us about these two kinds of memory.
Well, the memory that most of us think about is explicit memory. It's located in, you know, a part of the brain, and it's what we think of as, you know, fairly photographic, fairly much how we view ourselves. If we think of like what we did today and we remember back, that's that kind of memory. That's explicit memory. It's good for facts, but it has very, very little to do with this other memory system, which is implicit memory. And implicit memory is learning patterns. It's like learning prototypes. It's taking from a bunch of experiences and summing them in our mind, and knowing that inside of ourselves. There's so many examples of where we actually, by doing something over and over again, we learn it. And we start with, you know, like language, walking. We learn the emotional patterns of our family this way. What our parents and what our siblings do, their patterns, how they are, we learn. and we learn it like we learn language, and we learn the prototypes of that.
And carry us with us all our lives, unless we choose to make some changes?
Unless we choose to make some changes and then find a way to actually make the changes. We're not going to think our way out, but we have to find a way to make those changes. The adage that we can tell our children what to do, and that'll work. It won't work. Our children will see how we are, and that's what they'll learn. That's how they'll be.
There, something you said just connected. Melanie Mitchell talks.
Who is a computer scientist who is known worldwide for something called genetic algorithms, which are a tool within the computer science world.
She told us that fundamentally she believes if you can crack pattern recognition, mm-hmm. you can crack intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting perspective, and she has some very good arguments behind it. Interesting, but I've always I was thinking what they're trying to do is mimic the way the neocortex works, and what you're describing right. is that this holy grail for her and lots of people like her is actually something that functions in the limbic rather than in the cortex, the neocortex.
Right.
That's astounding.
Right. And actually there are forms of computer thought, neural network theory that are closer to actually how neurons work all over the brain.
What is so striking about this is what you're saying and what she's saying, and I think, I'm not sure she would agree with it, but implicitly, is that intelligence resides at least partially and maybe substantially in the other place, in the emotional place, rather than in the rational place, in the neocortex, which is a radical. Now I understand why you're why this is so challenging.
Yeah,
but maybe you don't have to pick.
We don't. It's a blend.
I mean, you're arguing for integration.
We're arguing for integration, but we're also arguing for correct a bias. Don't hold the old bias, because it gets all of us into trouble. Give the limbic system its due. Give the emotional system its due. And in some ways, we better give it its due, because we're not really doing that, and society is having a heck of a time because we're not doing that.
Well, you have some pretty scathing things to mm-hmm. say about American society in particular and Western society in general, about what happens when you walk away from the limbic system right. and a general theory, if you will, a general sense of how important it is for mm-hmm. us to be attached. Mm-hmm. And it isn't pretty.
No, it's not.
Tell us some of these not pretty things.
Well, if you don't attach and you don't have a relatively consistent person to attach to, you basically don't tune your body, you don't tune your brain, and you don't learn who you are. So your body's out of whack, you're not thinking well, and you have no idea who you are. And you're wandering around in the world looking like a human, but you really are a kind of a shell and not a very stable shell. And that's scary. And it's scary if that's happening more and more, because it's something that's lost. Like that shell, if that shell has a child, that shell will not be able to take care of that child and teach that child.
Jumping ahead, aren't you saying that there are lots of people, us out there, in that condition, and that our institutions are reflecting that condition?
Well, and this is not, you're not just talking about pathologies. You're talking No. about a more broadly based affliction.
Right, right. And it does reflect a bias. I mean, our bias is attachment, connection, stabilization of our body and our minds, and a sense of knowing oneself. Some people say, heck with all that stuff. I want to achieve. I want to make money. I want to just do those things. And it's helpful for me to not care about people, to be ruthless, to have a tremendous amount of aggression and have it barely under control. And it doesn't matter if I die from a heart attack, I'll have fun, you know, through my type A situation until I'm 50.
Which, when then you die from all the stresses that you've...
Hollowness. Yeah, the hollowness is...
People say, well, but, and I've, you know, I've got the zillion-dollar house and the six cars in the garage, and I feel hollow. That's precisely...
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. Yeah, and this, but a lot of people, in a sense, will be so driven to get all those things, and our society encourages that, that it's not until they have all the things that they do look inside and realize, oh my God, you know, what don't I have? Sometimes they can't see at all because they don't have it.
And what is it that they don't have?
They don't have a bunch of things. They don't have a sense of themselves. So they don't really, when they look into themselves, it is hollow. They don't have a textured sense of internal self. They also are usually alone. So they have, like, isolation. Usually the relationships don't work. So they don't have any of the joys of relationships, and usually their families are in trouble. And so, if anything, they have emotional pain rather than happiness.
Your book talks about the general theory of love. You don't say a great deal about love. In a way, what I think I'm seeing is the predicates, the things that make love possible.
Both things. Love we really define as that sense of connection and that sense of attachment that we all have for each other as human beings. We're not talking about sexual love. We're talking about that affiliative love. If things go optimal, if you know, in terms of the laws or rules of the emotional life, then one achieves a state where they can really enjoy intimacy, be there, know themselves, be able to know another person, know that they're separate from them, that they both, the other person and themselves, have needs. They're different needs, they're different people, but they can relate to one another. And that, in really, in our society, would term love. That's the optimum love. And so if everything goes right, that's what we get.
This is Dr. Richard Lannan. We'll be back in just a minute. I won't spend any extra time talking about how we're in San Francisco. Please be with us when we return.